Welcome to a new episode of the Tennis Lifestyle Podcast. I'm Gianluca Sola. It's been a while, but today's episode is really, really interesting. I chat to John Lafney de Jager, also known as JL. John Lafney, he was a former South African professional tennis player. He was a doubles specialist. Very good doubles player, achieved a career high of 11 in the world and won 7 titles. He also played the Sydney Olympics and the ATP Doubles Championships. We talk about his playing career, obviously, but he's involved in many other projects and does many other things, including he has his own academy in Pretoria called JL's Academy, Tennis Academy, where a lot of good junior players are training. He's also a motivational speaker and mental conditioning coach for many teams, also rugby, not only tennis, and high-performance athletes. Talks about his life growing up, very interesting story about what happened to him at his birth, which led to him having his right leg slightly an inch and a half shorter than his left. He talks about all of that. He was also a coach and an A-star level coach, ATP qualified. He also coached the UAE Royals, which was that tennis team based in Dubai. And that competed in the International Player Tennis League. And he's also the head coach of the Springfield Lasers, which are a world team tennis franchise in the USA. And many other things. He's also the founder of a tennis foundation called Matchpoint Tennis Foundation. And he also talks to us about organizing the Match for Africa, which happened right here where I am in Cape Town. All of you will know that his company organized that, and he talks about how he got Federer, Nadal, Bill Gates, and the South African comedian, my Trevor Noah, just slipped there for a second, how he got them all together and broke the world record for attending a tennis match. That was very cool. So yeah, he talks about lots of things. Listen to it. It's really interesting. I hope you enjoy it. I'm organizing a few other interviews coming up. I haven't stopped, don't worry. And I hope you enjoy it. Follow me on Twitter, on Instagram, Facebook. I'm not super, super social media guy, but I do post here and then. And I hope you enjoyed. Ciao, ciao. Hi, John Lafney.
Gianluca, how are you?
Fine, thanks. Can you hear me well?
I can hear you, man. Sorry, I apologize for being late. I just had a little issue.
No worries. Fine, thank you. Thanks for joining me on the podcast. I really appreciate it, especially on a Sunday.
Thank you for you. Appreciate it, man. Can you hear me clearly?
Yeah, no, perfect, 100%.
Okay, great.
John, how is it? Are you in Pretoria?
Yes, yeah, I'm in Pretoria, yeah.
Okay. And is it a nice day there as well? Because we're having a stunning day here in Cape Town.
Yeah, no, this is good. I mean, the last 2 days was a little, we could feel it's getting a little colder. Friday, Saturday was rainy. So today is actually a nice day again. I watched the rugby yesterday. I saw it was beautiful in Cape Town.
Yeah, especially today's really, really beautiful. But anyway, is it okay if I call you JL? You said on the WhatsApp.
JL is fine. Yeah, that's 100%. Most people call me that because that's the easiest.
Okay, great. I'll do a bit of an intro. You're a former South African professional tennis player. You've had a career high singles of 313. But you were more
known for your doubles with a career high of 11. You can correct me if I'm wrong. You also won seven titles. You reached four Grand Slam doubles semifinals, two mixed doubles finals, fourth place in the Sydney Olympics in 2000, and also qualified for the ATP doubles championships in 1999. As far as coaching, I see you're a grade A star GPTCA level coach, which is certified by the ATP. I think you're the only one in South Africa. You're currently captain of the South African Davis Cup team. Is that correct?
No, not anymore. Actually, I resigned about, probably four, 5 years ago. I resigned.
Oh.
I was captain for 10 years, and I was
Okay.
also the Fed Cup captain. But I resigned
Okay.
from Davis Cup, probably 4.5 years ago.
Oh, okay. I saw. No, I must do better research then. On there was maybe Wikipedia needs to update
Yeah, a few
there.
people think I'm still Davis Cup captain.
Who's the current captain? Is it?
there's a new one. Christo van Rensburg has just been named the new Davis Cup captain. Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Yes.
Okay, but you're also the founder of a tennis foundation, Match Point Tennis. You're the owner of a tennis academy in Pretoria, JL's Tennis Academy, a motivational speaker, mental conditioning coach for high performance athletes. You were also involved as a head coach with the UAE Royals, which was the part of the International Premier Tennis League, which was quite a few years ago. That was in Dubai. The team was based in Dubai that you coached, and also the Springfield Lasers, which is a world team tennis franchise in the USA. So yeah, that's quite a lot. I've probably left out something, but as I was doing my research, I realized there's so much I have to talk to you about. So this could be long, but I don't want to keep you too long. Maybe we'll have to do two or three podcasts.
Yeah, no, I listen. I mean, I have a lot of time, so you can whatever you want to need to talk about or want to talk about, we can discuss it. So I've been
Yeah.
very fortunate, I've been very fortunate with my career and opportunities that I've had. So yeah, I'm very blessed and privileged that everything that I was able to do so far.
No, it's fantastic. No, there's a lot I want to talk about, but you can keep it short and we'll see where it goes. I usually just have a discussion, and then at the end, I've got a rapid fire quiz,
Yeah.
which is long. But I mean, with this, I mean, you've had amazing tennis and life experiences, but where did your tennis begin? Where did your tennis journey start?
Look, I've got a very I have an interesting story because when I was born, my mother's heart stopped and my heart stopped. So when I was born, they had to give me a shock injection to get my heart going. They injected me in my butt instead of my thigh. Because the nerve system of a baby and a grown-up is the same. It's only basically the size of the butt that. So they hit the nerve going down my
Okay.
right leg. So I literally, until today, I only have 10% use of my nerve in my right leg. So I have no movement in my feet. Only 10% use of my nerve. The doctors, when I was born, the doctors said I'll never be able to do any sport. I have 12% chance of walking properly. I was in a cast until I was 3 years old. I had to wear build-up shoes until I was 18, and I was not allowed to wear barefoot.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was literally, the prognosis from the doctors when I was born. I was fortunate that, we lived on a farm. My dad did sport, and my dad had said, "Listen, my son will do sport. We live on a farm. He's going to walk barefoot," and that actually saved me because the fact that I was walking barefoot helped me to become flexible. But I mean, I was literally for my first 3 years of my life, I was in a cast. Then I wore
Okay.
build-up shoes. My right leg is an inch and a, was an inch and a half shorter than my left leg. I have an amazing, experience that I went through in '95. When I went to a faith healer and she prayed for me, and my leg grew. So that's where I
Wow.
started with my. That's where I started. Tennis was never my favorite sport. Rugby and cricket was the two sports that I loved doing. Tennis was something that I did during the weekends and during the holidays. I played a lot of tournaments, but my biggest thing, the the turn came in my career when I was 12 years old. We went to play in America, and I became the first South African to win in Port Washington in New York. I was the first South African to win that tournament. It was a big junior tournament.
Given me even more information here. Unbelievable. But so when did you actually start playing sports?
When I was very little, as soon as, you know, I was able to, you know, start crawling and playing, my mother would put a tennis racket in my hand just to keep me busy. On Sundays, she'll dress me up before to go to church. I had a tennis racket, you know, in one of our guest bedrooms. There was a wall. My dad actually put a wall, you know, a tennis net. He drew a net on that thing, and I was just hitting balls against the cupboards and against the wall. So that's how my tennis started. You know, we basically in our garage then, when my dad saw that I enjoyed playing tennis and ball sports, he was always, you know, said that we needed to do everything, you know, not just one sport, everything. So I literally played everything: rugby, cricket. I was playing tennis. I was in the choir. I was in the band at school. Everything. And it was that's how I got into it. And then obviously at 12, when I got this first international experience of playing tennis, I thought to myself, okay, maybe I must give this sport, you know, I must take it up a little bit more serious, because at that stage, rugby and cricket was two sports that I paid most attention to, not tennis. Tennis was something I did on the holidays. You know, it's something, the sport that I loved, but it wasn't like my favorite sport to do.
Okay. Wow. Amazing. So at 12 years old, you go overseas and you sort of did that spark. Did you then from then take tennis a little bit more seriously or focus on it?
Because I came sixth at the Orange Bowl when I was under 12. Then the Orange Bowl. I came sixth at the Orange Bowl. In my under 14 year, I came third at the Orange Bowl. Obviously, that was year after.
You must have been, I mean, that's an amazing result. You must have been playing already unbelievable at that age.
You know, now that I think back, coming third at the Orange Bowl, it probably, you know, at that level, you know, you'd say that I was playing at a high level. But at that stage, you know, I was just playing. I mean, I was not even thinking about it. I was very fortunate, obviously, with my junior career, playing a lot of, you know, international tournaments. And, I was packing, my father passed away, and we were, you know, cleaning his house. And I have a whole set of trophies that I won at the Orange Bowl. Doubles, I was in the doubles finals under, you know, I came 6th under 12, 3rd under 14, under 16, I made the first year under 16, I made the doubles finals, second year under 16 doubles finals. First year in the 18s, I won the doubles. Second in the 18s, I won the doubles. So I've got a lot of Orange Bowl trophies. And I was fortunate, you know, with playing with Wayne Ferreira when I was 16, we lost in the finals of Junior Wimbledon.
As a 16-year-old. Wow.
Yeah, I lost. We lost in the finals. And then the following year, I lost in the semis. And then my final in the 18s, I lost in the finals of the doubles of Junior Wimbledon. And we won the US Open Junior Doubles title. So from a young age, I was playing really well in doubles. Obviously, with my leg, you know, singles, I wanted to play singles, but obviously my movement were not that great because, I mean, I literally had a disability. You know, my disability in my leg was so serious that in 2000, when I went to the Sydney Olympics, they did a test on me and I qualified. I would have been the healthiest guy at the Paralympics.
Okay. No, but that's unbelievable. I didn't know this about you, and that's incredible. So your, let's call it, disability, is that really what led you to play doubles more than singles?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, people remember me as a doubles player, but my first big thing that I did was I became the second youngest South African to qualify for singles at Wimbledon. Wayne Ferreira qualified when he was 18, and I qualified when I was 19. I qualified for Wimbledon in July, and then I played that whole year. I played, obviously, I tried to play singles and obviously doubles, and I actually went over my ankle 6 times, you know, not tearing any ligaments, but just because my right leg's you know, was weak because of my disability. And then January of that next year, when I was still 19, Marcus Andruska and myself, we made the semifinals at the Aussie Open. And there I became the youngest South African to get to a semifinals. We lost in the semifinals at the Australian Open. But in the first round, I tore my ligaments in my right ankle. And we carried on playing and ended up losing in the semis. After that, I came home, and the specialist that basically looked at me, you know, was my doctor, you know, to help me, you know, from a young age with my ankle. He just said, listen, if you continue playing singles and doubles, you will play for 4 years, and then your back will be totally screwed up. So, you know, I made a decision. I made the semis. I was ranked like 70 in the world in doubles. I was going to get into most of the big tournaments in doubles. My singles ranking was like 311. And, you know, I just said, listen, if I can only play 4 years, if I want to play, I don't want to have a career when I can play 10 to 15. I was just going to play doubles. Sure. That's literally how I decided to just focus on doubles.
Okay. Very interesting. Amazing. Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. And obviously it was the right decision. I'm going to jump a bit because, I mean, there's so much I want to talk to you about, but I might jump here and there. But if you have to choose your best memory of your playing career, is there one in specific one?
Well, definitely when I qualified for Wimbledon in singles. I mean, I was 19 years old. It was always my dream to play at Wimbledon. And, you know, I played my final round qualifying against Steve De Vries at Wimbledon. I beat him in 4 sets. I mean, I remember it was the first time that I would play 5 sets. I never knew what it would feel like. We're playing in Roehampton on the cricket pitch. I mean, the bounce was so bad. We always joked, you know, if you play there, you don't hit the ball bounce. You chip and charge the whole time. And I ended up beating him in 4 sets. And that feeling when I won match point, knowing that I've just qualified for the biggest singles tournament in the world, has always been my dream. That definitely stands out as probably my biggest tennis moment.
Okay.
It was always a dream. And then obviously representing my country in Davis Cup and Olympics was always a dream. And so the first time when I did that, you know, at representing my country in Davis Cup, and then when I went to Olympics, was very special for me.
Okay. Yeah, no, I've actually heard a lot of players say that, funnily enough, players that also won big titles say the first time they qualified for a Grand Slam is their best memory. And I kind of understand that, And what's your best title? Is there one that you really remember as your best title that you won?
You know, again, I always go for, I mean, I would say my first one. We were in Russia. I played with Morris Barnard. It just leading up to it, I mean, I lost a lot of close matches leading up to the tournament. Was the last tournament of the year. I actually was so tired of losing tiebreakers. I actually phoned my dad and I told my dad, listen, I'm coming home because I'm sick and tired. I've lost so many tiebreakers the last 3-4 months. And my dad said, but what about your doubles partner? You're supposed to play in Moscow. And I said, no, it's okay. You know, you can find somebody else. And my dad said, no, that's not how I brought you up. If you made a commitment to somebody, you finish it. So he said, you'll go to Moscow and you'll play with Marius. And after the tournament, you can come home. And it's amazing how things turned out because we ended up playing and we ended up winning the tournament. And that was my first big ATP tournament I won. I went from 120, I went from like 170 in the world to, I think, to like 110 in the world. And that obviously that following Australian Open, we made the semis and then I was in the top 100. So if my dad was somebody that just, you know, said, yeah, come home, you know, I never probably would have gotten that breakthrough. So that title in Moscow was massive for me.
Very important. Yeah. You played mostly with South Africans you seemed, well, not only you, but many doubles people, but you changed a lot of partners. There was Koenig, David Adams, Gary Muller, Christoph Rendsburg, Marius Barnard, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'll probably missed quite a few there. But was there a partnership that you had more success with? And was there one that, if you had stuck to it longer, would have developed into an amazing partnership?
Well, my best results came with David Adams. You know, in 2000, we were ranked number 4 in the world as a team. And we made, you know, we were seeded number two at the US Open in 2000. And that was my best, you know, my best results came with David Adams. I think, you know, I made a mistake, you know, to break up with him. You know, Ellis Ferreira asked me to play with him. I've always wanted to play with Ellis, and then I got the opportunity. And, you know, now in hindsight, you can always say, oh, I never should have done it. But, you know, I think, you know, David and myself, we're a good team. We played, we beat all the best teams in the world. You know, in 1 year, we beat the Woodies three times. In 1999, we beat Woodbridge three times in 1 year. And we beat them in big tournaments. So that was definitely my best partnership that I had. And in ranking-wise, you know, we did really well. I also had a good relationship. You know, the Robbie Koenig he's probably one of my best friends. And, you know, I really enjoyed playing with him. But my whole thing started out with Christo van Rensburg. I mean, Christo van Rensburg was my mentor. You know, I was very young. I was 18 when he took me under his wing. I traveled with him. He played doubles with me. He gave me my first breakthroughs, you know, winning challenges, getting me onto the ATP ranking with doubles. You know, just practicing with him, learning a lot from him. He was big mates with Ivan Lendl. So I got an opportunity to train with Ivan Lendl a lot as an 18-year-old. So Christo played a massive role in my development. And one of the things that he really taught me was, you know, you need to believe in yourself and you need to get a coach. I mean, I remember I was playing with so many people and Christo told me, listen, if you want to be in the top 10 in the world, partner, and you need to find a coach that can coach you and make you better, and then we can go. You know, it was very interesting how he helped me, you know, find somebody. I didn't have the money to pay for somebody, or I thought I didn't have the money, and he actually forced me to use my little bit that I had to pay for a coach. And he made a deal with me and he said, you know, if I don't make more than that the next year, he will give my money back plus interest. And I ended up getting a coach. He helped me and I made like seven times more money that year, that first year that I had a coach. That just taught me a lesson that, you know, you need to believe in yourself and you need to put money, you know, into your game.
To invest in yourself, basically, if you want to.
Yeah, people always say, oh, they ask for sponsorships. And, you know, I'm always, you know, after that, I learned, you know, get a sponsor, I need to get a sponsor. And I'm like, how much of your own money are you investing in yourself? I mean, you want other people to invest in you. But if you can't invest in yourself, I'd expect people to believe in you if you can't believe in yourself.
Was there a doubles couple or player that when you played, you found just one of those that you found extremely tough, you could never beat them?
You know, like I said, you know, Woodbridge Woodford was obviously, you know, they, you know, after the Bryan brothers, they were probably the best doubles team in the world, but they were solid. They had solid first serve, solid return, solid volley. So when you knew when you played against them, you know, you're going to hit a return, you got to hit a first volley, they're just going to be solid. But Knowles Nesta was a team, they were a great doubles team, but they were powerful. So the day when they were on fire, these guys can literally destroy you. I never felt with Woodbridge Woodford that they can beat us 1-1, 1-2. But Knowles Nesta can destroy you. So for me, they were a team that was very dangerous. And because they were a lefty-righty combination with both of them big serves, big returns, they were, for me, they're probably one of the most difficult teams to play against.
Okay, very interesting. I've had previous South Africans, and I've asked them the same question. And around your era, South Africa produced a huge amount of top doubles players. I think up to 10, 15 at a certain point were in the top 100.
That was we were 17.
17? Okay, yeah, well, they're right there. I'm wrong there, but that's amazing. Why did South Africa produce so many good doubles players? And, okay, it did produce a few good singles, but why did that not translate into singles?
You know, in South Africa, obviously, in those days when we played, there was no money. I mean, we didn't get a big sponsorship from the federation or from companies in South Africa. So we tend to go overseas. We play in futures. Then what happens is, you know, we'll lose first or second round in singles. But because we grew up on high altitude, we knew how to serve and volley and play doubles, we'll make the semis or the finals in the doubles. So now next weekend, you can't qualify for singles because you're in the finals of the doubles because you're making money. So now you win the doubles, now you make some money. You miss a tournament, then the next week you play qualifying, maybe you win one or two rounds, but you make the doubles finals again. So what happens is that we tend to have more success in doubles early on. And because financially we were had to make money, we were making money from doubles and we didn't pay so much attention playing singles because, I mean, we always joke about it, you know, in singles, when you start out, you buy your points. You go to places, you play, and you don't make a lot of money, you know, and the points that you get is not a lot. But for us, it was a lot of us, that was how we started, is that guys would do a lot better in doubles. They'll make money. They'll make the semis, finals, win tournaments, miss out on qualifying, and then end up sticking with playing doubles because you get into the big tournaments, you get your ranking up in the top 100, and then you start making good money. So that was one of the reasons for me why South Africans, we produced more doubles guys than singles guys. And a lot of our kids that went to college did really well in college in doubles. And then they come on the tour and they do well and they play doubles.
That makes a lot of sense. And it's absolutely true. Yeah, it's a very good answer. I mean, because I think so. Obviously, playing in altitude and maybe that pushes you also to play a bit more aggressive. So, that idea of having to play doubles in futures, that explains it very well.
This is a very interesting thing from our era, that era that produced so many players that was in the top 100. In 1999, there was 32 South Africans that played at Wimbledon, men and women, singles, doubles, mixed doubles. Only the US had more players than us in 1999. Yeah. We were 17 guys in the top 100. We were 5 guys in the top 15 in the world in doubles. So it was Ellis Ferreira, David Adams, myself, Wayne Ferreira, and Pete Norville. We were all ranked in the top 15 in the world. And team-wise, Ellis and Rick were ranked number 2. David and myself were ranked number 4. And Pete and Wayne was ranked number 7.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely amazing. You know, I'm South Africa's my, I'm Italian, but I've been here 20 years and my family's South African. But it's funny, I grew up playing tennis. I'm a club player. I'm nothing special. But I grew up playing singles, and now I'm here in South Africa. And when I go play at the club, it's like everyone wants to play doubles all the time.
Yeah, that's true.
I kind of understand this whole thing about doubles, but you know, now I do. But yeah, it's very interesting. Just changing completely now, at your academy, JL Tennis Academy, just briefly, if you can tell us a little bit more about it. I've got a couple of sons who play TSA juniors, and they kind of know a few of your players. I think maybe the one that's doing pretty well now is Badenhorst. I don't know if he's still with you or not, but I know he was training with you. Am I correct?
Yeah. So we our academy is based here in midstream. We do the tennis at Midstream College, Midstream Ridge, at Brooklyn Union Tennis Club, Club View Tennis Clubs, where we have our academy. So yeah, we run a normal academy that most coaches do in South Africa. You know, we cater from a very young age, you know, kids that start out playing tennis 4 or 5 years old, you know, with red ball, up to, you know, players that play on, you know, on professional tournaments, and obviously junior. So, you know, Devin Barnes, definitely, you know, he's a young, talented boy. He's only 16. You know, he's about 103 on the ITF rankings at the moment. Obviously with COVID, it's tough because we can't travel and, you know, play a lot of tournaments in Europe and the US, but you know, he's a good player. I mean, I'm 6'4", he's taller than me. I think he's only at 50% of his capacity where he can be. You know, I think one thing that he needs to improve, and a lot of South African kids, is the physical part of it. You know, we're a little bit behind international players. It's not something that we pay so much attention to. Devin is definitely a player that's doing well. You know, we've got a few other juniors that in the under 12, 14, 16 category that's got talented players. So yeah, we basically, for me, it's the big thing about when it comes to my academy, it comes, you know, we want to develop. I'm not a coach that focuses on results, because there's too many parents and too many coaches that focus so much on results when kids are young. And then when it really matters, when they're 18, you know, you know, they hit the ceiling, you know, so for me, it's a big thing of developing, you know, our biggest thing is, you know, for me is to develop, you know, the player to, and first you develop you as a champion person, and then you can become a champion in tennis. I have a saying that if you're a champion person, you have all the ingredients to be successful in life. And we need to use sport to teach kids about life, because not everybody's going to make it as a professional sportsman, but can you use sport to teach you how life works?
That,
because you have great days, you have bad days, you get injuries, you know, so sports such teach.
For me, that's very important. So I don't like to talk about rankings,
but your people that follow that just chase rankings because we'll be in the top 10, under 14, under 16. It doesn't
develop as a player.
The better you play, automatically you win more matches, you'll get your ranking up and start, you know, if you want to become a professional player, you know, you'll slowly, you'll move up the ranks and get your ranking up.
Yeah. No, I can't agree more. I think, I think especially with tennis, the chances of being a professional are so slim. I would focus more on what it can give you as a human being. And then if results come, great, you know, it's probably a better way to look at it, maybe. I don't know. Here's another question. And I'm not trying to be I am a bit critical, but always about the level of tennis in SA. And I mean, we could talk a lot about this, but I know you are a proud South African. But however, South African tennis probably right now is in a very poor phase. Let's be honest. You've got, I think, in the men, Kevin Anderson, fantastic, great player, huge achievements. He's dropped a bit. He's got injuries, and he's getting, you know, a little bit older. Lloyd Harris is doing extremely well. He's in, I think, 50 or 60 in the world. He's got a bright future. But after that, I think there's only one player in the top 1,000. If we go to the women, it's even worse. I wouldn't even, it's nearly inexistent. And I'm not trying to point fingers at any players here. I mean, tennis is an unbelievably difficult sport. And in my opinion, if you're a top 1,000, you've achieved a lot. But, you know, it's nearly inexistent. So what do you think is the problem, and what can the federation, and what can be done to improve it, or do you not agree with what I'm saying?
No, definitely. I mean, we always are, you know, trying to figure out, you know, how we can help, you know, develop players to become better. It's definitely, I mean, it's concerning. I think, you know, Tennis South Africa and a lot of work, you know, to develop the game, get more competitions in place, ITF events, futures events, the high school and the primary school event that they're doing. My biggest thing is I think that Tennis South Africa still hasn't got a very good high performance program. So what are they doing for the best kids in the country to get them together to train and get them overseas? Like when we were younger, we were in a squad. So we had the super squad and the elite squad. Stafford, Marcus Andrischka, Kevin Elliott, Brendan Curry, Clinton Marsh, Robbie Koenig. We were like 9 guys that all trained, and they said, if you want to get help from the federation, you have to move to Joburg. So we, or Pretoria, we had 2 coaches that worked with us here in Pretoria. So if we were not training in Pretoria, we were traveling overseas, playing tournaments. And out of that 9, probably 7 of us played 5 or more years on the tour, and we're all in the top 100 in the world. What's happening in South Africa is that, you know, because there's not a central, central base academy or you know, national center where people can train, everybody is doing it on their own. So the coaches are protecting their players. So Tennis South Africa now has appointed Jeff Kutsi as the director of tennis, obviously with the, you know, trying to, you know, get people to work together more. Christo's Davis Cup captain. Christo's got a few ideas that he needs to, you know, want to get involved. Yonette Kruger, that was top 50 in the world in singles, you know, she's the director for women's tennis. So, I mean, they're trying to, you know, get the right people involved with experience to help them. I always felt that they didn't have enough people with experience to, you know, help our coaches to develop, because I mean, it's, if I coach a 12-year-old girl and I don't know what's happening on the professional circuit, on the women's circuit, how am I going to teach this girl what to do?
Yes.
You know, I was, my last 4 years as a coach on the, you know, was with the women's tour, on the WTA tour. So I was the most experienced coach working with women in the world and working with women that's top 50 in the world. I've never been asked by Tennis South Africa to come and help the junior girls, even though I had the most experience. So for me, it's like, can you get the right people to come and help you develop? So, you know, they're on the right track, you know, with the right with people that they're getting involved. We have to sit now. We have to sit and see what they're going to do. My biggest thing is we need to get a – there's not one academy in South Africa that can say they have a true high-performance program like they do in Europe, in the States. Mm. You know, so if one and you know, the thing is, people say we always have to leave. We don't have to leave. I mean, Lloyd has proven that, you know, he can get into the top 100 in the world out of South Africa. You know what? He had a he has a sponsor that helped him travel. That's our biggest thing. South Africa is the financing. Yeah. It's a lot of money to travel. I mean, I worked out a budget.
Yeah.
You know, if we want to do it properly with a coach, fitness trainer, hotels, everything, your budget's like 1.2 million a year. I mean, and which parent has that amount of money to invest in your kid for a period of 5-6 years before they start making money? So that's
exactly.
So, you know, thing I don't think that high performance tennis is top of the list for Tennis South Africa. I know they've got a lot of other things that they've got to pay attention to, and they need to do that. And they're doing a great job with that. But if we want to start developing more players, then that's one thing that they will have to improve, is their high performance program for our top juniors.
Okay. Yeah. No. Very well said. And also, maybe as I've spoken to a lot of coaches, also on my podcast around the world, etc. Don't you think also there is a really a big lack of tournaments? You know, as far as futures and even ITFs, something that maybe they should also try and increase.
Well, I mean, even Tennis South Africa has done a great job with increasing the amount of ITF tournaments and future tournaments in South Africa. Yes, we can always get more, but I know with the ITFs, you have a limited amount of tournaments that you can host in South Africa, and I think we've reached our limit. The fact that we have a great A tournament in September, there's a great two, and then we've got a bunch of great fours and fives that's in the country. So that is awesome. Our biggest challenge is, like a kid like Devon. Devon's ranking is not affected anymore if he plays a J4 or J5. His ranking can only go up higher now if we have a grade A, a J1, J2 in South Africa. We only have a J1, a grade A. That's great, but it's only one of them. The rest of the time, he needs to travel. So, and that traveling comes... We have to fund it ourselves, or the parents have to fund it. And I think that's where the big challenge come in. And you'll see most of the kids that have high ITF rankings are kids that have funding so they can travel.
Yeah.
Billie Jean King has got a great saying. I was very fortunate when I was 18, I played world team tennis my first time. I played with Martina Navratilova and Billie Jean King was the coach of our team. So I learned a lot from them, and you know, she's got the saying, she never asks kids what's their ITF ranking, because she's got the view that kids with a lot of money, they can get high ITF rankings because they can play a lot of tournaments.
I'm not an expert or anything, but it's quite obvious if you're into tennis. I mean, I think with money you could really go far. I'm not saying you know you're going to become a great player, but you know, it's something that your ranking can come quite high if you've got the money and the time to travel and play certain tournaments. But if somebody doesn't have any money and doesn't have a sponsor, would you say maybe going a US college route is the best or only route to go for a junior who's good?
Well, Gianluca, for me, that's the only route for us to go. Because if you literally don't have, you know, about anything in the excess of between 600,000 and a million rand a year to pay for your kid, you know, the college route is the best route to go, because I don't think there's a lot of kids that right now is good enough to just go and play on the circuit. Because remember, you know, if your ranking is 800 in the world, you get your ranking down to 300 in the world. A lot of players make that mistake. They go play some futures, they make a few points, their ranking drops with like 500 spots, and now suddenly they think they're professional tennis players and they're going to make it.
Yeah.
Where it's tough. Yeah. I mean, when you're 300 in the world, you haven't made it. You're not a professional tennis player. In my view, you're only a professional player when you make money out of your profession.
Yeah.
If you still can't break even, you're still trying to become a professional player. You're not a professional player. You know, it's a great
and that's probably about the top 150 in the world, from what I've heard.
Yeah, about that. I mean, Raven Clausen tells a great story where he was ranked 300 in the world and he played a money tournament in France. And he had this older lady at the tennis club came up to him and said, you know, are you a professional tennis player? And he said, yeah, you know, I'm a professional tennis player. And she's like, what's your ranking? And he's like, I'm 300. And she's like, oh, you're not a professional tennis player. And then it made him realize that in France, when you rank 300, you're nobody. In South Africa, when you rank 300, people think, oh, you play professional tennis. But in a country that's got, I mean, hundreds of kids playing and a lot of players in the top 100, top 200, 300 is not a good ranking. So for me, it's the college route is the best route to go, because you will go, you get a scholarship. Firstly, you can get your education. Secondly, an assistant coach. You have strength and conditioning coaches working with you. You have 8 to 9 other players that you can train with on a daily basis. You play. Then
you
get to know people. You get to know the boosters of the people that support. So when you're done playing and you want to then decide to play professional tennis, the opportunity to go and play and maybe get somebody that financially can help you is so much better. In your four years playing, in the holidays, you can play ITF tournaments and you can travel with some of your teammates, so you're not on your own. Where now, if you don't go to college, you go and play in a future, you have to play qualifying, you may be losing the qualifying, you have to wait a whole week, play.
Yeah, and then maybe you're on your own. Yeah.
To play
everything. So that's why the college system is a very good system for me. And people don't realize that. Yeah, at one stage the college tennis went down a little bit.
The level of college tennis right now is very high. I mean, if you just look at the UTR rankings of the top college players, men's players, I mean, it's higher than a Serena Williams, Halep, and
No, I think in college, from what I've seen and heard, I mean, if you're playing, let's say, in position 1 or 2 in the top 30 teams in the US, you are a serious player. So, it's definitely a good route.
No, definitely.
Just changing subject now. I didn't know you were involved in the Match for Africa. That happened a few years ago here in Cape Town. Can you just briefly tell us a little bit more about that? With the Federer and Nadal, obviously, event, and there was also Bill Gates and Trevor Noah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I was fortunate. You know, I've got a very interesting story with Roger. I met Roger for the first time, you know, literally when he was 12 years old. I mean, I played in Basel. Robbie Kunig was my doubles partner. And, you know, we arrived at the tournament, walked into the accreditation office. And, you know, Roger's mother, Lynette, she was in charge there and, you know, wrote down our names. And she looked at my name in Afrikaans. She said, you must be from South Africa. And I said, yeah, I'm from South Africa. How are you? And we started talking Afrikaans. And she told us about you know, she's from Kempton Park and, you know, she's married to a Swiss guy and her son is one of the ball boys. He wants to play tennis. And that's where we met. And it was funny, you know, in Cape Town during the event, we were talking, Robbie and myself and her. And she said she went home that night, told her husband that she met 2 South Africans and she feels so bad because they probably think that she's typical, this mother that think her son is going to be the next number one in the world. And not knowing that, you know, how great he's going to be. So, you know, we stayed in touch and obviously Roger started playing. He started playing on the tour, you know, while I was still playing. You know, we played, you know, some doubles matches against, I played some doubles against him. And, you know, it became friends, you know, knowing each other at the tournament. Obviously, you know, knowing that we're from South Africa, he's from South Africa.
Moving on, becoming a coach, you know, coaching on the tour, saw him a lot.
And then, you know, when I was, we became the coach of the Dubai Royals and the IPTL, you know, Roger played for me. And I knew his agent, Tony Gottsick. That's a great guy. You know, I've known him for a long time. His wife, actually, Mary Jo Fernandez, played team tennis. And I've always told him, I said, listen, Tony, I know at some stage Roger's going to come to South Africa. And, you know, we're ready to host, you know, our company New Boundaries with my partner, Holger Losch. You know, we've done it before. You know, we both of us were involved with Serena and Venus came to South Africa. So I said, you know, we're ready. We can host a great event. And, you know, and then I started talking to Tony. Tony said, you know, Roger's thinking about it. You know, before we could set a date, you know, they said, no, we'll, you know, Roger's got too many things. We'll set it out. Then the second time came around, third time came around, and the fourth time came around, and he said, okay, we've got a date now. And what we wanted to do is, I mean, obviously, if you host an event like that, you know, indoor events always good because, you know, weather will never play a role. You can make a great show. And I actually just, you know, I was talking to Tony and I said, listen, you know, we can pack a stadium when Roger comes to South Africa, and we should play in a football stadium or a rugby stadium. And, you know, we can, I was thinking of the F&B stadium. We can pack 100,000 people in there and, you know, break a world record. And just thinking big. I mean, I always just, you know, I always think big when I do things. And yeah, so the conversation started and, you know, they came up with a few ideas and they said, yeah, great. You know, let's do it. So it was, so it was great. You know, so our company, New Boundaries, with the organizers, with the help of Team 8, Rogers Agency, you know, Rogers Foundation, and then we, Big Plus is a Swiss company that does all Rogers events and the Match for Africa events around the world. So, you know, so we were a great partnership, you know, 3-4 groups that helped us. And yeah, we you know, we went around and we looked at all the stadiums and, you know, Roger wanted to, you know, he wanted to play in Cape Town, and the Cape Town Stadium was a beautiful event. And yeah, so that's how it started off. And, you know, what an amazing event. And, you know, it was awesome for us that we were able to break the world record.
No, that's amazing. And how did you get involved? Or was that that pulled a few strings?
Well, no, I mean, sorry, just hang on one sec.
Yeah, no problem.
No, basically, so literally Roger, obviously, he basically for Match for Africa, you know, Roger basically gets the players who he wants to play and they come. So Roger, you know, got Nadal involved. He does a lot of things with Bill Gates. And then obviously with the Swiss South African connection, he thought that Trevor Noah, that has a Swiss dad and a South African mother, would be a great fit. And that's how those four players got together.
Okay. No, that was great. Yeah. I mean, I think it's left everybody I know who went there, it's left a big, big impression. And it was just great to have that. Just another final, I'm sort of getting towards the end. I mean, we could talk a lot more here, but I know you had the amazing experiences with the UAE Royals and also which was that tennis league, that the International Premier Tennis League. I think it was 2014 to 16, and also with the Springfield the Lasers. You obviously got to meet, play, coach with a huge amount of legends, let's say, in the tennis world. I mean, you mentioned Federer, but I think there's also Ivanovic, Ivanisevic, Hingis, blah blah blah, to name a few.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, no. Do you is there any player you got along with very well and who you became close to? And is there any players that really surprised you, like as people?
You know, I mean, most of those players that played in that league, I mean, I knew from my playing days that I played with. So the younger generation guys, we knew from obviously like Roger, you know, I still played when he was starting to play out. And so I knew all of them. There was nobody that I didn't really know that well. I mean, obviously when you play in a team environment, it's different because, you know, you spend time with them, you get to know them a little bit more, you know, intimate than just, you know, seeing them at the tennis court. So all those guys, you know, the thing that stood out for me is like how professional they are in a team environment, how they can switch and become, you know, team players. Roger Novak, I mean,
they obviously was unbelievable how they were with the team, because I mean they were obviously the superstars. Goran Ivanisevic is the funniest guy. I mean, I've been friends with him for a very long time. You know, we played doubles together as well, and you know he was so good for our team. He's a character. He's always some funny stories that he tells. The guy that stood out for me was Thomas Berdych, because if you look at Thomas Berdych, he would look so serious always. I always thought that, geez, this guy can never smile. And it was very interesting because I got into the elevator with him at the IPTL, and I told him, I said, listen, I've known you for a long time, but I really never knew that you could smile. I said, because I watched you yesterday and you were great on court. That was the first year of IPTL. And then actually we became, better friends. And then the next day he played in our team and he was amazing. Yeah, I mean, he's such an unbelievable professional. He works so hard, but awesome for our team environment. The thing that stood out for me, from these the celebrity players how they're individuals, but they were some of the best team players that we had. Roger, Rafa, Novak, I mean, Goran, those guys. I was fortunate. I played mixed doubles with Martina Hingis. You made the semis at Wimbledon. She was played in my team. Ivanovic. Then in team tennis in the US, Andy Roddick was amazing when he played for us. You know, he stood out there. He was so good with signing autographs for everybody. Martina was unbelievable. I mean, as an 18-year-old playing world team tennis for the first time with Martina, I remember, we would go into a press conference. This press conference would be packed and they would only ask questions to Martina, and she would literally ask four or five questions and then said, listen, I have a team here. You ask, if you want me to answer another question, first ask all these guys questions and then I'll answer a question. When they will have a van for us and a limousine for her, everybody goes in the van or everybody goes in the limousine. Everybody stays in the 5-star hotel or we stay in the motel. She was very good with that. And
very down to earth.
Yeah, I was very fortunate that I was able at a young age to spend time with some of the greatest players that played our sport, because I could learn a lot from them. And my dad always taught me, listen, when you're around these guys, you ask a lot of questions, you open your ears and you listen, and you take the stuff that can fit into your roadmap where you want to go. The biggest problem that parents do is they read what Nadal, Federer does and they try and copy them. But you need to know what your pathway is, because Nadal might practice 6 hours, but for your kid, he only needs to practice half an hour maybe.
Yeah.
You can't copy. I always say you only copy and paste on a computer. You need to figure out what's your roadmap, what you need to do to get to your destination, and then take from the best in the world and see what they do, what you can fill in, what's going to fit and help you to get there ASAP.
Yeah. No, very, very, very true. Very well said. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's... amazing. And is there anybody that was maybe a bit too difficult that you had in the team?
You always have, I don't want to, say names, but you have one or two people that are a little difficult. But in a team environment like that, players sort each other out. I mean, that's where the IPTL, we had a girl in our team that was a little, she was younger and, she thought she was a lot better than what she was. And Goran Ivanisevic one day just sorted out. He sat us straight in front of the whole team. He just said, listen, you're behaving like a prima donna. You're nobody. You might be somebody one day, but right now you're nobody. You get your act together. We play in a team. Let's go.
Okay. Goran is quite, Ivanisevic is either... The one who sorts things out.
Goran is, Goran is the type of guy, he has a way of saying things. People never get mad at him. He gets away with a lot of stuff. But, he's a great guy. I mean, I really see him as a good friend. I think he was an unbelievable tennis player and he's an unbelievable coach. And that's why I'm not surprised that, he's coaching Novak right now and he's had so much success with different players. Because he's a great guy, and I really enjoyed him, as a team member and a team that I coached.
Okay. Lastly, is there something in tennis that you would still like to accomplish? Do you still have a goal or something that you want to accomplish?
I mean, it'll always be you always want to push yourself, and I'm just my, you know, personality. I want to try and be the best at what I do. And, you know, when I coach, I want to be the best, you know, obviously trying to develop somebody that can be in the, you know, the best singles player in the world. I mean, I've been fortunate to coach guys that win Grand Slams in doubles and become number one in doubles, you know, but it hasn't happened that in singles. So I definitely, that's definitely one thing that I would really want to do. I really hope that, you know, I'm busy now with a little bit of something different with my mental conditioning business. You know, I'm helping rugby teams. I'm busy with the Tikkies Varsity Cup team. I'm helping them. I have individual sportsmen that I work with. You know, I think that through the years with my experience, you know, as a tennis player, individual sport, hanging around some of the best sportsmen in the world, you know, that I can, I have ability, and with my disability that I had and in my experience, to take people to the next level. You know, I see my work as, you know, to help you go to a level and to a place that you never thought you could go to. You know, and I enjoy helping people. That's a passion for me, to add value and help people. And in team environments, you get to work with a lot of players. So right now, you know, I have a focus on my mental conditioning business and, you know, getting involved in the rugby and helping, you know, some of, you know, I'm helping some of the better players in South Africa. And then obviously, you know, spending some time with Devon, because I really think Devon has the potential to become a good player. There's obviously a lot of water that still has to run into the sea before, you know, he can. But I mean, I think he has ability, and I definitely want to spend some time with him, and hopefully, you know, he can become the next South African that can get into the top 10 in the world.
Okay. Oh, wow. That's, yeah, I didn't want to ask you that. I mean, my son is actually the same year of Devon, and we've seen him play. I see him play all the time. So, okay, so you're going to try and see where that goes. Let's put it that way. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, we're going to, you know, I think potentially he's good. I mean, for me, at his age, what I'm going to say now doesn't really mean anything, because when you're junior, it doesn't mean. But for me, he's better than what Kevin and Lloyd was at their age, at 16. And for me, he's not even close to the opportunities that they had at that age, and, you know, the ability that they had. So, but it's, you know, it's a long road. It's a process.
Yeah.
There's no guarantees, but I really think that he has a shot of, if he does the right stuff, he gets the right opportunities, you know, he definitely has somebody that has the potential to make it.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. And obviously I know that you're a rugby fanatic, so obviously your mental conditioning is part of that as well. Great. Thanks a lot. I'm not gonna keep you too longer, but I usually end with a rapid fire quiz. You can quickly just keep it short, or if you want to elaborate, you know, I don't mind, elaborate. There's all kinds of questions. So are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Okay. What's your first memory of tennis?
Hitting tennis ball against my mother's cupboard.
Define, if somebody's never seen you play, what type of player you are.
Aggressive serve and volley.
Is there a current pro that says resembles the way you play?
It's interesting. No, because there's not a lot of serve and volleys out there anymore. So,
yeah, I was going to say that. Yeah, what's your best shot?
My best shot was my backhand return up the line.
Okay. Current favorite player, male or female?
Roger.
List the big three from favorite to least favorite.
Roger, Novak, Rafa.
Okay. Which is the best tournament in the world? Sorry, can you repeat that? I couldn't hear you. Hello?
The Indian Wells Master Series.
Oh, okay. I can hear you now. Okay, great. What tension did you use when you played? String tension.
Very tight. I used to string my rackets between 68 and 72 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, do you have a favorite all-time racket?
You know, I used to play with the Prince Precision. That was a racket that Patrick Rafter used as well. So I played with that racket for a very long time, even though when they took it off the market and they made a new one, I got a batch off Patrick Rafter. They colored it. It was a red racket, became a white racket, but it was a different one that was in the store. So he actually gave me a lot of his rackets, leftovers, so I can keep playing with that racket. It was the Prince Precision.
And you still play with that?
No. I was sponsored by Prince, but the last, I don't know how many years now, I've been sponsored by Wilson. So my academy is sponsored by Wilson, and yeah, I play with Wilson now.
Okay. You have to book a restaurant and invite three players, male or female, any era. It doesn't matter. Which restaurant do you book and who do you invite?
Well, my favorite restaurant in South Africa is Pachas. It's a restaurant here in Pretoria. I would invite Federer, Steffi Graf, and Bjorn Borg.
Okay, nice combo. And what type of restaurant is that? What type of food
They literally have everything. It's a combination, but they have the best spare ribs and best calamari in the world.
Okay. Great. Do you like cooking?
If Bri is cooking, yes, I do.
Yeah, no, South Africa, it is cooking. It's the pinnacle of cooking. Your favorite food?
My favorite food is meat. I grew up on a farm, and we used to have meat four times a day, and we used to joke that we used to eat meat every day of the week except on Wednesday. We'd eat vegetables. My mother would give me a chicken. That was my vegetables.
That's funny. Do you have any sort of hobbies outside of tennis or sports?
Yeah, I love to. I mean, when my back permits it, I love to play golf. I really love playing golf, and growing up, I was big into horse riding. We grew up on a farm. We have a lot of horses, so yeah, horse riding was something that I did show jumping and shows, so I stopped doing it less when I started going overseas. But horse riding was a huge hobby of mine.
Okay, a lot of tennis players are superstitious. Are you superstitious?
No. I'm not. I didn't even know. When it comes to my rackets, I didn't. People ask me my weight, what type of strings I'm playing with. I have no idea. So I was very fortunate, because I think when you become superstitious, it can get really into your head.
Okay. How many hours do you sleep on average?
I would probably tell you not enough. 4.5, 5 hours, because I get up every morning at 4:30 to train. I have this thing where I constantly try and challenge myself and take myself out of my comfort zone. And it's something, everything that I have a philosophy that, with coaching and with the mental conditioning, you can never ask a player to do something that you haven't done or that you're not prepared to do. So if you tell players to take themselves out of your comfort zone, I always say, okay, what are you doing right now as the coach to take yourself out of your comfort zone?
Okay, very interesting. Yeah. Favorite country? It can't be South Africa.
That will probably be Australia or the US. I really enjoy both those countries.
Favorite city?
Melbourne.
Okay. Is tennis the most difficult sport in the world?
I would say so.
And if you were not
in this big competition, there's always this thing about what's more difficult, tennis or golf.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of people will tell me one of those two. Yeah. If you were not involved in tennis, what would you be doing right now?
I would be a rugby coach.
Okay. How will tennis look like 30 years from now, in 2050?
I think it's going to be a lot more where people will come, guys will come to the net because the court's not getting big or smaller, but players are getting faster. You don't see guys hitting just plain winners from the back. So the only way to make points short are, you know, to come to the net again. I definitely think that people will, you'll start seeing a little bit more creative play going forward.
Okay. I'm going to give you a shot and you must tell me the best, well, whatever comes to your mind. Serve.
Goran Ivanišević.
Return.
Novak Djokovic.
Forehand.
Roger Federer.
Backhand.
Roger Federer. Novak Djokovic.
Volley.
Stefan Edberg.
Drop shot.
Roger Federer.
Movement.
Rafa Nadal.
Mental toughness.
Rafa Nadal.
Touch feel.
John McEnroe.
And presence aura.
Boris Becker.
Oh yeah, excellent. A lot of people go with Becker with presence aura. Yeah, that's interesting. Excellent. Thanks, JL. That was excellent. I always finish my podcast with this question, and it's basically ask yourself a question and answer it.
Ask myself a question and answer it.
Yeah.
Phew, that's an interesting angle to take things.
Yeah.
It
look, it doesn't have to be serious, but yeah.
Why do you think what's your job on in this world? And my answer will be to help people get better and to change lives.
Okay, fantastic. Excellent.
Thank you,
we've just gone past the hour, Mark, and I really enjoyed it. I think I could have talked a lot longer with you, but it's Sunday, and I've also got a bride that I have to start.
Hey, lekker.
By the way, because a lot of my listeners are foreigners, a braai is like a barbecue. I'm just letting everyone know that. It's a South African barbecue, yeah. But I really enjoyed it. Maybe I hope to see you somewhere in some tournament soon or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that'll be awesome. Thank you for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.
Great. Have a nice Sunday, whatever's left.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Okay.
Take care.
Cheers. Thanks. Bye bye.
Bye. I'll tell you no matter.